You are listening to the podcast of Providence Church in Austin, Texas. We hope this message raises your affections for Jesus and helps you live out the gospel in everyday life.
I was thinking this week about some experiences I've had in my life, and it kind of brought up this dynamic that I wonder, I assume probably you have experienced. And it's this: have you ever had a profound experience of some kind that radically changed, at least in the moment, your whole perspective on life? Just who you are, what you're about, your purpose, you know, something like that. And in that moment, you felt like, okay, from now on, everything changes. From now on, I'm going to live differently. Have you ever had that kind of moment? But then, and not very long after that, you're kind of living the same way you always were. You haven't actually changed that much. I don't know if you guys ever experienced that. It's like the guy who, or the girl, but it's usually the guy. It's like Uncle Ted. He eats so much at the family dinner, you know, and then like he ends up laying on his back on the floor and he's just moaning. He's like, oh, and he says something like, I may never eat again, right? It's just a couple hours till Ted's like thinking, ice cream sounds good. I'll go get some ice cream, right? Okay, it's that kind of dynamic. Some of you have been up close to real situations of poverty. You've gotten to know people who have real needs, and that did something to you. You thought, okay, I'm going to live more simply. I'm going to be more generous. I'm not going to give in to the materialistic and excessive desires that I have before. Some of you just got caught doing something you weren't supposed to do, and the embarrassment of it, the guilt, the shame of it made you in that moment think, all right, I'm never doing that again. Some of you, you've experienced this with God. Like, you've had moments where you believed in God. Maybe even felt his presence, like, in a very palpable way. But then you have other moments where you're full of doubt. You doubt God's goodness. You question whether or not he even exists. Is he even here with us? Why are we like this? Why is this kind of experience so common, really, to all of us? It's not a new phenomenon. We've been looking at the book of Exodus, and in fact, one of the things we see in the people of Israel, God's people, is this dynamic, this sort of fickle and forgetful cycle that they go through in the relationship with God and with each other. We've seen this pattern. Let me give us some context. In Exodus 14, they are backed into a corner. Pharaoh and his chariots are coming to get them. There's no way out, and God rescues them and delivers them through the Red Sea. And they walk through the Red Sea on dry land, and they get to the shore. And then they turn around, and they see the waters come down on Pharaoh and his chariots. And in Exodus 15, they sing a song. They sing and dance. One of the lyrics is, God is our strength. God is my song. He has become our salvation. Singing and dancing in Exodus 15. This was one of those moments. Things were going to be different now. They were going to be different now. Exodus 16, though, they get hungry. Ice cream starts to sound pretty good. And they start to grumble against Moses and against God. But God provides for them. He gives them quail, which is delicious. And he gives them manna, which is this miraculous bread from heaven. And not just one day, but they will actually eat of this bread for the whole 40 years that they're in the wilderness. It's miraculous. They're full again. But then they get thirsty in chapter 17, and they begin to quarrel with Moses. And this word quarreling is different than grumbling. It's kind of a step further. It actually is a legal term. It means they're bringing a charge against Moses. They're taking him to court. Exodus 17 is, in many ways, a courtroom scene. Now, I don't want you to forget that everyone who's grumbling and everyone who's quarreling, every single one of them walked through the Red Sea between walls of water. And they got to the other side and they watched their enemy go down under God's mighty hand in those walls of water. They all experienced that. These are the people who are grumbling and murmuring and quarreling. They sang and danced because they saw God deliver and provide. You know, I got to think on the shore, they're thinking, okay, that's it. If God is fighting for us, if he is for us, then who could possibly be against us? If not even Pharaoh and his chariots can overtake us, then why would we ever worry or fret or fear ever again? I think that's one of those moments, and they're thinking that. But then they get hungry and thirsty, and their singing turned into suing. It is astonishing to me how quickly we go from things like worship to doubt, from praying to worrying, from blessing others to gossiping about them or cursing them. Why are we like this? And furthermore, what do we do about it? Because I think we all admit it. We're all like, okay, yeah, that's me. But what do we do? Well, I think Exodus 17 gives us some really helpful insights into why we're like this. And even more than that, I think it points us to what we should do. Exodus 17 is going to give us some answers to this dilemma or this dynamic that's present in all our lives. So here's what we're going to do. We're just going to walk through this text. And as we go, we'll sort of peel back various layers that help us get to the bottom of this mystery in our lives. So open up to Exodus 17, verse 1. This is the first layer. We're just going to look at their situation, sort of examine it a little bit. 17, verse 1. All the congregation of the people of Israel moved on from the wilderness of Sin by stages, according to the commandment of the Lord, and camped at Rephidim, but there was no water for the people to drink. Right? This is their situation. God is leading them through the wilderness en route to the promised land. And the wilderness is not easy. It's what it sounds like. It's a desert. It's difficult. It's not a place where you can often meet your own needs. Like when I go on a trip, everybody gets this feeling too. You're on your way and you're like, I forgot something. And you don't know what it is. It could be like a little thing or something really important, and you sort of try to dig for it, and you can't figure it out. I always come to this point where I think, okay, well, whatever. I'm gone now. I've got my wallet, so if I need something, you know, I'll just buy it. Or I've got my phone, so if I can call somebody to get what I need. I always sort of like take security in that fact. The wilderness is not like that. This is like being in a remote country with no communication or no currency. All you have is what is there. And in this case, there isn't much there. There's not even water to drink. And like, water's a big deal. That's a serious thing. I mean, in 16, they're hungry, and that's important, but you can actually die of thirst much, much faster than you can die of hunger, and it's more painful. This is a serious situation. There's no water to drink. You know, when you're thirsty, I mean really, really thirsty, it's like you can hardly think of anything else. You know, like if you were there in their shoes and someone asked you to describe, like, hey, what's your situation? What's going on? All you would be able to talk about is how there's no water. Like, you might have blisters on your feet. You might be in a fight with your wife. You might be, like, struggling with depression. But none of that would matter compared to how thirsty you are and the reality that there's no water to drink. This is all they can see. This is their situation. But it's not all there is. I want you to notice, how do they get to this awful place with no water? Well, look at the verse 1. They moved on from the wilderness of Sin by stages. How? According to the commandment of the Lord, and camped at Rephidim. Right, so this isn't like they took a wrong turn, they made a bad decision. No, they're following God. They're walking with God, trusting his leadership. They are right where God wants them to be. And so there's two realities in this present situation in Exodus 17, and here they are. They do not have water, but they do have God. Those are the two fundamental things that they're wrestling with. I'd like to suggest that our situation is really not that different than theirs. I mean, we do have water, of course. It's a little bit embarrassing how much water. I mean, you could go home and turn on your faucet. I was at Todd's house last night. All you have to do is even just touch his faucet and the water comes out. You could go home right now, turn on the faucets in your house, and just watch water run for hours. We have bottled water, flavored water, sparkling water. I mean, we are embarrassingly rich with water. That's not our problem. Yet we're still deeply thirsty. Our thirsts are for things like acceptance and pleasure, success, and we draw from all kinds of wells to try to satisfy and quench those thirsts. And the more we do it, the thirstier we are, because they just provide a temporary satisfaction, but then it makes the thirst go deeper into our soul. I read somewhere this week this quote. She said, "Our culture is akin to being dehydrated and floating in the middle of the salty ocean. As the poet Samuel Coleridge wrote, water, water everywhere, but not a drop to drink." We live in a world that promises all kinds of things to fulfill our desires, our thirsts, our needs, and yet, in spite of all that is offered to us, our spirits are still parched and longing. In spite of the experience you had, the moment of clarity where you decided to be different, you still end up, at some point, thirsty. What is the deep thirst in your soul? What is that thing that if you had it, life would be okay? You wouldn't worry or complain, at least not for a long time. If you had it, you would finally feel some kind of like closure or sense of peace or joy or security. What is that thing for you? I actually want you to think of something. This sermon will be so much more helpful if you have a thing in your mind. It could be financial security, a job that you want, a spouse, a different house. It doesn't have to be huge things. It doesn't have to be your deepest thing, but get a thing. Something that you want that you can't secure by your own means. You got it? Don't lie. All right. There are two realities in our lives. One is we don't have that thing. And the other one is we do have God. And so the question is, what do we do in light of our situation, in light of that thing, that situation that you have in mind? Well, let's look at what they did. Verse 2. "Therefore, since they were in this place and there was no water to drink, the people quarreled with Moses and said, 'Give us water to drink.' And Moses said to them, 'Why do you quarrel with me? Why do you test the Lord?'" In other words, Moses is trying to reason with them, but they're thirsty. They can't reason. They can't do logic. No. The people thirsted there for water, and the people grumbled against Moses and said, "Why did you bring us up out of Egypt? To kill us and our children and our livestock with thirst?" And so Moses cried to the Lord, "What do I do with these people? They're almost ready to stone me," Moses says. And that brings up the picture of the trial. You know, stoning is like, it's like the death penalty. I mean, it's a sentence that's rendered. And this word quarrel, again, is more than grumbling. They're bringing formal charges against Moses. They're taking him to court. In their minds, Moses is responsible for bringing them out of Egypt. He's responsible for bringing them into this place with no water. He has an obligation as their leader to provide for them. And he's not doing it. And so they are coming against him. They're pressing charges. They're bringing an ultimatum to the table. They're saying, "Give us water. And if we can't have water, we will have justice." The charge is in verse 3. "You brought us out here to kill us." And the sentence is in verse 4. "They're about to stone me." In other words, so they want to render a sentence for manslaughter that he hasn't committed yet. But they're anticipating it. They're certain of it, that that's what he's doing. And so they want to go ahead and render the judgment. What do you do when things go wrong in your life? Like just when hardship comes your way and it's not your fault. What do you do when you feel like you have done everything right and you still don't have the thing that you want to have? Well, if you're like Israel, if you're like me, you find somebody to blame. We can't possibly bear the weight of things not going right totally. And so we find someone to blame. And the blame game is a dangerous place. When you get to that place where you say, "If I can't have what I want, then I demand justice. I take justice into my own hands," that is a dangerous, bad place. And it's possible to sort of like discern if you're headed down that downward spiral, if you're going down that, if you're playing the blame game to its logical conclusion, because where it leads is bitterness and isolation and anger and judgment. It leads to things you don't want. It leads to despair. And so it's important to pay attention to your emotions and to your thoughts, to the tapes that are playing in your head about others, especially to see, am I headed down that path? So let me give you some indicators from this text, things that I see in them that maybe if you see in yourself, might raise a red flag. Say, man, I might be playing the blame game. Here's the first one. A sense of entitlement. Making demands. Right? In Exodus 15, there's water, but it's bitter. You can't drink it. And so they ask Moses if there's something he can do about it. But here, there's no asking. There's only demanding, give us water to drink. When you are holding on to expectations of things that haven't been promised you, you're going to inevitably lead into the blame game. When you demand that thing you want as if it is like in Exodus or Ephesians or something, which, by the way, the house you want is not anywhere in the Bible, all right? When you demand it, though, as if it's God's obligation to you, you're going to get into the blame game. Here's another indicator, impatience. Everything about this passage is hasty. I would like you to please note something very important, that is that they are still alive. They have not died of thirst. They only think they're going to die of thirst based on their assessment of the situation. In fact, you see this in Exodus and all through the scriptures and in your own life if you look back. There are so many places where you think it is the end of the road, yet there is still so much time for God to do something. And God, for whatever reason, likes to wait. Or he likes to make us wait. He likes to bring us to the end of ourselves so that we might turn to him in faith. There is time, lots of time here for God to do something, but they're hasty. And instead of turning to God in faith, they turn to Moses. They put the blame on him. They want to make a premature judgment, an execution of Moses. The other thing they do is they project out their situation to the extreme. They exaggerate the situation to the point that it puts them in a panic. All right, so they're thirsty. It's legitimate. It's a big deal. But look where they're going in their thoughts. They're like, you brought us out here, assuming motives. You brought us out here not just to kill us, but to kill our children and our livestock. I mean, this is the end of the road. None of that's happened yet. But that's where they've gone in their minds. If you go there, if you exaggerate your situation, you project the worst case scenario and then import it into the current relationships that you have and act accordingly, you are headed down a bad path. Here's the last thing. You don't turn to God. So when suffering comes your way, when hardship or puzzlement comes your way, you may turn to people. You may ask for counsel, even prayer, but you don't pray. Like, you don't turn. So if you find yourself in difficult times and you're not turning to God in some way, you will inevitably end up blaming somebody. They look to Moses. You know, it's interesting. In their blaming of Moses, they actually reveal that they're trusting in Moses to save them. He's not saving them. That's why they're blaming him. But the problem is that they're looking to him in ways that they should be looking to God. Nobody you know can bear the burden of being your God. They just can't. Blaming is delusional. It's holding on to false beliefs in the face of facts and reality. And that's where they are. This is what happens when all we see is our circumstances. We get thirsty. We don't see a way to quench that thirst. And so all we can see is that we don't have water, and we forget that we do have God. That's where they're at. That's where we're at. And that's why we don't realize that when we're blaming other people, we are, in fact, blaming God. Look what Moses says. He says, why are you quarreling with me? And then he says, why do you test the Lord? See what you're saying? Look, you're blaming me, but really, you're blaming God. Verse 7 bears witness to this real deep thirst that's going on in them. It says that Moses named this place Massah and Meribah because of the quarreling of the people of Israel and because they tested the Lord by saying, this is how they were testing God. Is the Lord among us or not? Underneath the blame against Moses, the deep thirst, the deep question is God with us? Is he real? All right, that's the clue. that question, is God with us or not? That's the clue that helps us peel back the second layer. So the first layer is what, just what's going on. The second layer, though, gets to the question of why. Why are they acting this way? All right, the question we began with is this. How can we go, essentially, from singing to grumbling? Or to put it another way, when we have those moments where we make good decisions, commitments, we decide we're going to be different, why don't we stay with it? Why are we so fickle and forgetful in those things? The answer in this text is that they're ruled by their thirst. They know about God, they believe in God, but none of that seems to matter as much as their thirst. James K.A. Smith offers some helpful insight into this. In this book, Desiring the Kingdom, fantastic book, if you want to read page after page and not quite understand what you're reading. But you go through it a second time and you begin to get it. Here's what he says. To be human is to love, and it is what we love that defines who we are. And he's talking about our ultimate love, not like my love of Veracruz tacos. Rather, we're talking about ultimate loves, that to which we're fundamentally oriented. What ultimately governs our vision of the good life, what shapes and molds our being in the world. In other words, what we desire above all else, that thing that you want. It's not what I think that shapes my life from the bottom up. It's what I desire. It's what I love that animates my passion. Now, I can't cover this in detail, but essentially he's putting that in contrast to some things that we've been told. We've been told that we're primarily thinking beings. I think, therefore I am. And we've been told, even a step below that, that we're primarily believing beings, that we sort of believe our way into feeling the right way or thinking the right way or understanding. And certainly your life with God and in your life in community involves thinking and believing, but what he's getting at is there's something more primal. We are at the bottom of it, from the bottom up, desiring, loving beings. They have experienced so much with God. They can think about God in good ways. They believe things about God in good ways. But they're thirsty. This is the desire, this is the love that is governing and ruling them in the wilderness. This is why God led them there, so that they could be thirsty. Because all of our thirsts, our desires, our loves point us to God. Our thirst is meant to expose our disordered loves, things that we've put above God. It's meant to break our hearts of those loves. It's meant to drive us to our knees before God so that we might love Him and His kingdom above all else. It's not wrong to want water. You need water to live. It is wrong, however, I think, to want water more than you want God. That is, to want life even more than God. It's not wrong to want most of the things that you're thinking about. A house, a job, reconciliation somewhere. I mean, it's not wrong to want those things. It's wrong, though, and I think impossible to secure those things in any other way outside of God Himself. It's wrong to hold those things as your ultimate source of joy and peace and happiness. They can't deliver. If we want to be quenched, then we have to come to grips with our deepest thirst. You have to see that your blaming of others is really blaming God. You have to see that your attempts to control others are really attempts to control God. You have to see that all of your discontentment with life is discontentment with God, and all of your dissatisfaction is really, at the bottom, disappointment with God. If you want that deep thirst to be quenched, you've got to get to that place where you're willing to see that. That's why God's out there. That's why they're out there. He's trying to show them these things, that all their thirsts are thirsts for God. A number of years ago, I was playing basketball with my son, Ethan. Now, my wife is like against, you know, fake food and sugars and all that kind of stuff. And so we don't have a lot of beverages in our house. We have, you know what we have? We have water in excess. But my kids, and me included, we don't really like water. It doesn't taste like anything, right? And so the other day, we were at the store, and I was looking for drinks for this hike that Ethan and I were going to go on. And I asked, Debbie was with me, and I was like, hey, so is there anything besides water that would be really good? She goes, no. No, that's all trash. If you want to drink trash, you can have that, or there's water. So in our house, we don't have a lot of good beverages, but and my kids don't like water, but we were out playing basketball, Ethan and I, and it was a hot night, and he had brought a jug of water because that's all we have. And so we play this game, and it's exhausting, and we're done, and he picks up this thing of water, and before we got there, I should say, he was complaining about not having anything but water. He picks up this jug and just starts chugging. I mean, water is just coming in, and he just like, I'm like, how can you hold that much water in your body? And I was kind of, I wanted to be snarky. I was kind of like, oh yeah, sorry about that, that we have water. Sorry about that. You know, we all need water. He asked me, he looked over at me, because he knew I was making fun of him for complaining about it and then chugging it. And he said, hey Dad, how come water tastes good, but only when you really want it? And I was like, well, I don't know. It's like Plato type question. It's sort of something really philosophical there. It's only when you're really thirsty that you become acutely aware of your thirst, of your need. It's only when we become aware of our deepest spiritual thirst that we begin to sense our desperate need for Jesus. By bringing them out into the wilderness, God is not punishing them. He's opening up places in their hearts and in their lives where water hasn't been able to flow yet because they haven't been willing. And he's bringing them low because water runs to the lowest places. How does he do it? How does he quench them? I mean, he opens them up, but how does he fill? That's the next layer. He actually gives them what they want. They want a trial, and so they're going to get one. Verse 5. The Lord said to Moses, pass on before the people, taking with you some of the elders of Israel and take in your hand the staff with which you struck the Nile and go. So these are the proceedings of a trial. Like in our courts, at least on TV, a judge is announced. He walks in, he takes his seat, that kind of thing. That's what's happening. This is a procession. Moses is walking in and he's bringing with him the elders. They are the jury. And he's got with him the staff, not just any staff. This is the staff with which he struck the Nile. It is a staff that represents the presence of God. And in that sense, it was a staff of judgment against Egypt. And so Moses is the judge. He's got the staff. So he's not on trial. But then he like passes on by the people. So they're not on trial. They're actually the prosecutor. So we've got a jury, we've got a judge, we've got a prosecutor. Who's the defendant? Who's on trial? Verse 6. Behold, God said, I will stand before you there on the rock at Horeb. To stand before is a term of humility. The word means something like a servant coming before his master waiting for instruction or maybe waiting for judgment. There's nowhere else in the Bible where God uses this word about himself or where it's used about God. But God says, I will take that place on the rock before you. Tim Keller says, suffering will either make God big and you stand before him, or it'll make God small and he will stand before you and you will demand an explanation. That's what's going on here. They're thirsty. They're suffering. And God becomes small. They become big and God stands before them and they demand an explanation. But how is Moses going to render judgment against God? He isn't. God is going to render the judgment. Look what he says. He says to Moses, first, I'll be the defendant. I'll stand before you on the rock. But then he says, I will also render the judgment. Here's what I want you to do. Strike the rock. Take the staff of judgment, and where I stand before you by the rock, strike the rock. What does it mean? It means there's something we need more than water. It means the deepest thirst of your soul are not thirst for money or approval or success. It means the deepest thirst of your soul is a thirst for Jesus. In 1 Corinthians 10, I believe, Paul is thinking back, writing about this scene, and he says explicitly, the rock is Christ. the pre-incarnate Christ, Son of God, is the one in the dock, as C.S. Lewis said. He's on the rock. He is taking the judgment of God's staff against himself for the grumbling and murmuring and quarreling people. This is the gospel. God is saying what you need more than water is the gospel. The good news that God saves sinners through the life and the death and the resurrection of Jesus. God has opened a fountain in the wilderness. And the only reason that's possible is because Jesus himself went into the wilderness. He was tested and passed. He lived the life that we should have lived. And Jesus himself was judged. He was struck on the cross. Blood and water flowed so that we could be saved. Why would God do this? Well, he did it because the people were thirsty. He did it so they could drink. Look what he says. You shall strike the rock, and water shall come out of it, and the people will drink. He gives them what they want. They want a trial, they get it. They want water, he gives it to them. Is this what you would expect of God? Is it what you expect of him in your life? Like when you're struggling, when you're doubting, when you've done that thing you said you would never do again, don't you expect God to be frustrated and fed up with you? Don't you expect him to strike you in some way? But look, he doesn't do that. He's merciful. He provides. His love is steadfast beyond your wildest imagination. Listen, if you are in Christ, the one who has been struck, there is not a time where God's looking at you and going, oh my gosh, seriously? Again, like what? That's not happening. Do you deserve the worst? Yes. What do you get? Blessing. Water. His own son in your place. It's glorious. John Piper says, Jesus doesn't just have what our souls need. He is what our souls need. That thing that you want, he can give it to you. But that's not the point. The point is that he gives you his very self. All right, if we're not primarily thinking beings, not primarily believing beings even, but we're loving, desiring beings, then what do? How do you get to the place where you want and love and desire Jesus, the rock, more than anything else? Well, let me close just by turning to John 7. You don't have to turn there if you don't want to, but we've said all along that Exodus is a story about what's happening with them, but it's also our story. It also points to what happens with Jesus and with us. And in John 7, there is murmuring and complaining. People are accusing Jesus. They want to arrest him. It's all the stuff that was happening with Israel and Moses. And the other thing that's happening in John 7 is the Feast of Booths. This was a festival that they celebrated every year to remember their time in the wilderness. And specifically, one of the things was to remember this situation, this water from the rock. So when the grumbling in the wilderness had reached a climax, Moses cries out, what should I do with these people? And when the murmuring, the muttering in John 7 reaches a climax, Jesus cries out. Verse 37, that's what it says. And he cried out. This isn't a lecture. This is a crying out, a pleading. And look what he says. John 7, 37. Murmuring, muttering, chaos. Jesus stands up in the middle of this festival and he says, if anyone is thirsty, come to me and drink. It's not a lecture. He's not saying, let me tell you how to think it through. Let me tell you what you need to believe. That's all part of it. But first and primarily, it is come and drink. Be satisfied in me. One of the ceremonies they had was the pouring out of the water ceremony. Every day, the priests would draw water from the Pool of Siloam, and they would walk in procession to the temple. The priests would read sections from Ezekiel and Zechariah about the streams of water that one day would come from the temple and bring refreshment and healing, nourish the people, and then the priest would pour the water into this big basin near the altar of the temple. This was all to help them remember that God had provided water in the wilderness. And it's when Jesus is watching that. It's when the people are singing from Isaiah 12, "With joy we will draw water from the wells of salvation." That's when he stands up and cries out, "Come and drink from me." Is God with us or not? Yeah, he's right there. He's in their midst. They're going through all kinds of religious rituals and motions, and they have missed God in their midst. He says, if anyone thirsts, the condition is thirst. He doesn't say anything about whether or not you're grumbling or quarreling or hiding from God or angry at God. He doesn't say anything about what you may have done or not done. The condition is, are you thirsty? If you're thirsty, then come. Not go. The answer's not somewhere else. It's in Christ. Come and drink. Take him into yourself. Let him, his grace, his truth, his love sink deep into every part of your soul. Have you ever seen somebody who's like really thirsty finally get a drink of water? It's like Ethan did that night. I mean, they take it and they just start pouring. There's nothing proper about it. Water is just spilling everywhere. They don't care what they look like. They have found what they really need. And Jesus is saying, if you're thirsty, come and drink like that. Let's pray.
Thanks for listening to the podcast of Providence Church. For more resources and info, visit us online at www.providenceaustin.com.